All right, this is Women's Focus that you're in tune to right here at KUNM. My name is Carol Boss, here with you up until 2 o'clock. I'm going to be introducing in just a few moments my next guest, Maggie McNabb. And right now, Sarah is back with us after that discussion. Thanks for getting that together, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you.
You have a calendar of events for us.
Yes, I do. First of all, V-Day is coming. The Vagina Monologues will be performed in Theater X in Popejoy Hall Saturday, February 18th at 8 p.m. and February 19th at 2 p.m. And if you want more information about that, it's women.unm.edu. And then on the 16th of February, Lenny Stern. I know we've been playing a little bit of her, I think Carol did, in her Freeform show. And she'll be performing at the Outpost Performance Space at 7:30. Stern is known for fusing rock and jazz with traditional African music, and she's won the Gibson Female Jazz Guitarist Prize for 5 years in a row. And going with the traditional African part for this performance, she's leading a quartet, and the three other musicians are from Mali, Senegal, and Nigeria. So that sounds really fun, and if you want more information about tickets, though, internet address is ampconcerts.org. So ampconcerts.org. Next, we have on February 17th and 18th, Bookworks will hold the New Mexico Organic Farmers Conference, which is an annual opportunity for producers and researchers from all around the Southwest, and especially New Mexico, to share their experiences and expertise in organic farming. And you can go to the Bookworks website for more info about that. Mala Manya, a 10-woman drum and vocal cumbia band, will perform at the Off Center Community Arts Studio on February 17th at 6 p.m. And the phone number for that is 505-247-1172. And on the 23rd, Low Spirits Bar and Stage will host an all-female comedy show. That sounds pretty fun. It's called The Ladies of NR Comedy, with a K, at 8 p.m. And tickets are just available at the door, so you would just buy them once you get there. And if you want more information, the website is lowspiritslive.com. And on February 11th at 8 p.m. and February 12th at 2 p.m., Air Dance New Mexico performs Fear of Falling at the Air Dance Art Space. And I've seen lots of flyers for this around town. It looks really beautiful. And the description is, the show explores the full range of human emotions through aerial dance and theater, featuring works on a climbing wall, aerial fabric, swings, and a triple trapeze. And if you'd like more info on that, you can go to airdanceartspace.com. And one final thing, for Black History Month, UNM is hosting a lecture series on Saturdays, open to anyone in the general public. They're from 11:30 to 1. You can bring a brown bag lunch. And it will be in the, there are, I guess you've missed, you're missing one right now, so sorry about that. But next Saturday, it'll be on the fourth floor of Mesa Hall, and the seminars explore the social, historical, moral, and cultural heritage and political struggles for the self-determination of African Americans in the United States. And if you want more info on that, you can call the Africana Studies program at UNM, 277-0111. I think that's it for this week.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so very much. I appreciate you getting that together.
Oh, sorry.
One more?
Yeah. I forgot about one more. There's the Art for Health benefit. This is at El Museo Cultural de Santa Fe. And that, it's basically just an art show. It's an event featuring culinary and visual arts, drumming, storytelling, political cartoons, and West African dance, performed by local artists and musicians, and that is to benefit women in Cameroon. And if you want more info on that, the website is HITIP.org. So HITIP.org. HITIP. I'm not sure. Okay. thanks, Carol.
Thank you, Sarah. Okay, this is Women's Focus, and I am Carol Boss. I'm glad you're joining me this afternoon. So my next guest, Designer and educator Maggie McNabb is the author of a new book, Design by Nature, which examines the versatility of nature and illustrates how to uncover nature's ingenuity and use it to create beautiful and compelling design. Maggie opened her own business, McNabb Design, in 1981. Her work has been published in design industry publications and has received international honors. She teaches design theory at the University of New Mexico and Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And she's the past president of the Communication Artists of New Mexico. So welcome, Maggie. Congratulations. And I really mean this on a very beautiful new book.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you here. I was wondering if you could... Well, let me ask you this. It's sort of a simple question, but on the other hand, depending on how you answer questions, it may not be so simple at all. To start off with, what is a designer?
Well, in my mind, a designer is any human being that walks the earth. I think it's our first occupation to design, because human beings have this capacity to imagine beyond what's right in front of their face. We can imagine beyond the literal. And then we have this ingenuity with our brains, which can be a good or bad thing, depending on how it's used, just like answering the question in a simple or complex way. But the ingenuity that we have allows us to take these ideas and actually make them real in the world. This is how civilization has been created, written language, everything that supports who we are as human beings today.
And as a professional designer, what do you do?
Well, I'm a communications designer, and really my area of focus and what I love doing the most is identity development, because for me that's discovering, finding the DNA of a company and figuring out how to create a symbol that appropriately reflects that, that's big enough. It's a container, you know. It's not just this simple little blip, which is kind of the way a lot of logos are used. It's actually something that can move and evolve with the company, that really does express them in an appropriate way, that is not too defining, but actually has something that's meaningful for almost everyone who looks at it. So that's really the definition of a symbol, and that's my area.
I like when you say finding the DNA of a company. That really kind of...
Yes, because that's where we evolve from, you know, whether it's an individual or a company, a business. It has this continual propensity, if it's healthy, to continue to have experiences and evolve and learn from those experiences and grow.
So tell us a little bit about your journey in becoming a designer and how that happened. You know, we were just talking to some young women, who a couple of whom want to be medical doctors, and
right.
Sometimes they have those thoughts, you know, when they're growing up. And I don't know. I'm sure there's some young people say, "Oh, when I grow up, I want to be a designer." But
Well, my life didn't exactly go that way. I had kind of unusual circumstances. I first moved to Santa Fe with my parents in 1960. So I was born in Texas. I'm not a native New Mexican, but I sort of consider myself one because my heart is here and always has been. And I started out on my own very young. I left high school a year early. I had been in school in Santa Fe, and my mother moved down to Albuquerque, and I needed one credit to graduate from my senior year. So I just did not see the value in spending another year of my life in high school. So I went ahead and started working very young. I was 16 when I began working full-time jobs, and I started for a small typesetter here in Albuquerque called, Typesetting Services of New Mexico, I believe was the name of it, and began as a runner there. And they taught me some basics about the hands-on stuff, like how to do a paste-up, how to shoot a stat with a graphics camera, how to set type. And this was just on the very front end of computers beginning to work their way into the business world. They'd already been in the military for a while, but they were beginning to leak into the private sector. And so one of the very first computers that came out were typesetting machines, and they were monstrosities, huge punched pieces of tape that went through these things. So I had this experience of hands-on instead of going to college, and I did eventually go to college, but not until I went out on my own at 25 starting my own business, because then I could customize the classes I wanted to take. I knew very clearly what I wanted to do, and I had a background of art, but I didn't want to be a starving artist like so many of my parents' friends up in Santa Fe. You know, I just saw that rampantly. And so I kind of veered towards the design of the direction of design, which back then was called commercial art. So,
well, making that decision when you were 16 years old says a lot about you and probably the family that you grew up with.
I had very creative parents, and they were definitely not mainstream type of people. They were, I guess you might call them bohemian a little bit. My father was an architect and an artist for, he worked for John Gamim when I was a kid in the mid-60s, and he helped design St. John's College. That was one of his big projects.
Say a little bit, for those who are not familiar with John Gamim.
John Gamim actually designed a lot of the territorial buildings here on campus.
That's
at
right,
UAM.
Right.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And I can't remember, he had some South American connection, and I can't remember if it was Brazil or Chile, but he spent quite a bit of time down there, and he had this real appreciation for indigenous art and natural forms. He wasn't as famous as Frank Lloyd Wright, but he was one of those architects from that era that kind of, by the time my dad worked for him, I think he was in his 60s or 70s, so
right.
He was well along in the 60s. But my dad also was a very creative architect, and the stuff he did off the clock, though none of it was actually realized except his own mother's house, was just really pretty amazing stuff, just very Frank Lloyd Wright, very indigenous to the area, very organic, looked like it rose right up out of the earth, like a lot of the Pueblos do here.
Mm-hmm. So with me today is Maggie McNabb, and she's the author of Design by Nature. Now, when I was first approached about the idea of doing an interview with you, certainly, Design by Nature caught my attention. Now, there's a subtitle, Using Universal Forms and Principles in Design. So I was thinking to myself, before going any further, I need to check out this book, because the subtitle, to me, made it sound like it was a very specialized book and it was going to be beyond me. However, I want to say, for those of you who are not in design, who are not professional designers, don't let that subtitle scare you, because I want to tell you what drew me to your book was the article I read that was in last month's New Mexican, in the Pasatiempo section. And in it, you said the tenets of your design philosophy are applicable to all people who find themselves walking a creative path. So I have to say, I thought that article was excellent. I'm going to probably bring up in this conversation with you, in this interview, some of the things that were brought up in there, because I thought it was really excellent. I was very interested in what was written about you. But that whole thing about the creative path made, and I thought, okay, this book is not just for quote-unquote professional designers.
That's right.
It could be for many of us.
That's right.
And that's what opened me up to wanting to talk to you and reading more about it and then receiving a book from your publisher. And it really is a beautiful book. You talk about aha moments in your book, but for me it was an aha moment. And this is as much about this is about creativity for many of us. And I want you to start talking right now about your philosophy of design and its relationship to nature.
Well, you know, all human beings are incredibly creative. We are such an imaginative species. So design is not just for any particular profession or discipline. It's really about designing your life. And, you know, what better mentor to look to other than nature, the container that holds us, that nourishes us, that feeds us, that takes care of us. And
can we back up a moment?
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt that thought, but
yeah.
Why don't you, before you go ahead and talk about that, talk about the role of nature, but your upbringing, especially it sounds like with your father.
And
the importance of nature and how that was so much a part
of
who you are.
Yeah, nature was always seen in our family as sort of the supreme being. And my parents took me camping, and my dad especially, because he'd been a cowboy down in Las Cruces back pre-World War II.
A real cowboy?
He used to be a cowboy. He rode cattle down on what is now White Sands, which was a ranch that was usurped by the government as a testing range. So he knew the family that had cattle on that range, and he used to ride down there. And horseback riding and drawing, I think, are two of the things that I really got from my dad, and this real appreciation for nature, and not just things like, you know, the sky and the land, but also animals. And I've always had animals be a part of my life. And my parents were just very much that, you know, that goes back to that connection with the bohemian thing. And I think a lot of people post-World War II, my father went to World War II, as did all the young men back in that era. And he just saw things that he thought were horrific and unnecessary. And, you know, where do you go with that kind of thing? I mean, except back to nature when you've seen how those things can be so twisted in a human version that may not be, you know, as it should be, as a balanced kind of a situation. So my parents were always, they were always very much part of rebelling against the machine, I guess you might say. That was a big part of their lives, mm-hmm. and it became a part of mine. They were Unitarians, though really non-attending Unitarians. So I don't. We just had a lot of interesting experiences when I was a kid. We knew a lot of artists and poets, and just interesting conversations. And I was usually until a certain hour, of course. I got to meet the people and talk with them a little bit. And there was a lot of rapport between generations, between disciplines. So I've always had this very eclectic approach, I guess, to life. And it must be rooted in the kind of experiences I had as a kid.
So the relationship of design with nature.
Yeah,
talk
well,
about that.
I mean, nature is the designer supreme. You know, nature has been doing it for billions and billions of years, and nature just does what's appropriate. You know, it's such a simple formula. It does what works. If something doesn't work, it gets taken out right away. You know, it's very, very simple. But human systems, unfortunately, they get built up and they become these massive structures that cannot be shifted so easily. And so we get kind of ensnared in our own systems of design that may not be suitable anymore. And so, you know, the book is about communication design primarily, of course, because that's my 30-plus years of background. But it's really about just recognizing what works and what doesn't, and really doing that on an individual level from your heart out. And that's what I try to teach my students, to do what you love, do what's important to you, contribute yourself to the world. You're here for a reason, and don't let anybody tell you what that is, because you need to unfold it. You know, it's an exploratory project, but you need to really follow what feels right for you. And I think that's just a really important thing to reinforce to people right now when we're under such strenuous systemic things right now that are not necessarily working in their best capacity.
A quote from you, I guess, I think it was from the newspaper article, an interview. It amazes me that human beings and modern culture feel so separated from nature, and yet we can't possibly be apart from it. We are nature. If we disconnect ourselves from that truth, then there's nothing left. I kind of feel like it's my job to do the best I can to teach those who come into my classroom about appreciating nature and understanding how things work, and then teaching them how to apply it to their own lives, not just to design. So it's sort of, you're really talking about, I guess, the universal experience of nature.
Right, because all humans have a common experience. I think all humans, we do get a little twisted and warped sometimes along the way, but most humans want the same sorts of things. You know, we want to be able to do productive work. We want to have healthy relationships. We want to be able to contribute to our communities. We want to be able to live good lives. You know, I think that is a universal thing. And the universal principles that I discuss in Design by Nature, there's not a lot of them. They're very fundamental, simple things. But, you know, like breathing, which is just a part of our every moment of every living day, we don't recognize it. We don't have any awareness of it because it's such an everyday thing. The universal principles are very much like that. We're receiving sensory information all the time from the world around us, and we're not processing it up here. We're processing it in our hearts, in our guts, you know, in the solar plexus area. And I learned just through my work of needing to be an effective designer, but aesthetics were always important to me too, because I think that's what captures the audience. Then it has to have value to for them somehow so that they spend time with it. It can't be part of all the meaningless noise. It has to be able to get through that so it can make it into consciousness and actually create a connection for the viewer. So there's just, there's so much information junk in the world right now. I think there's something like $7,000 or $8,000 messages per day that people are exposed to. TV ads, internet pop-ups, radio ads, billboards, just all kinds of visual information that's got no value for us. It doesn't contribute anything to us.
That's an incredible number. You didn't just grab that out of thin air.
No, I did not.
That's amazing.
I'm sorry, I can't cite the source.
I was reading about this
recently in the last year or two.
That's a fascinating statistic.
Yeah.
It's a little depressing, too. Yeah, it is huge. So talk about one of the principles. Give us an example. You said there aren't many principles.
Well, one of the universal fundamental principles is a value exchange, which I just use the very, very simple definition of the word value, which is a fair exchange. Most of us want that in our lives, and most of us are fine with giving something and getting something back that is what we decide and agree between us is fair. So there's a lot of things that are going on right now that people are seeing as not being fair. And so there's this schism in culture that is happening now with people having the awareness that things are not fair. And nature only works in principles of balance. That's the only principle there is. Everything else is unworkable.
Until someone screws with it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. And then it's not only universal principles, it's also universal patterns, of which there are not a whole lot of patterns that make up all of the diversity around us. There's really a handful of so of patterns like branching and spirals and storing patterns, because these are the patterns that take energy in a three-dimensional world and move it from one place to another, connect it, or store it so that it's out of the way but readily accessible as soon as it's needed. So these are some basic patterns that happen in nature, and they're all around us all the time, and we intuitively understand them, but we very rarely consciously think about them, just like we don't think about each breath going in and out of our bodies.
Well, you know, from a few things that you were quoted about in the New Mexican article, which you can find online, it's in January's issue. In a January issue, I don't know the date of
January 13th.
January 13th. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're not really bashing the educational system, but you're certainly taking issues with some things. I wrote down a couple of quotes, one being, the current educational system is not working, especially for designers. It doesn't teach people creative problem solving, and we're in a place right now as a species that we have to be able to solve the problems we're dealing with in a very creative way. We need people who can think well beyond what they've experienced, and I love this. And standardized testing doesn't get us there.
That's right.
Say it is like it is, and that's
we
absolutely
we need to be very, very – we need to take on who we are as a species, which is to be very creative. We are great problem solvers. We're amazing problem solvers. But when we get obstructed and overburdened or diverted in systems that don't really support us being all that we can be, then, you know, we have a lot of people who are shut down. They're ensnared in jobs that they don't particularly like or have passion for. And to me, that's just – I just don't believe – now, this is a personal opinion, okay, and I try not to throw too many personal opinions out there, but I really think human beings are here on the earth to contribute themselves in a unique way. And I think it's important to have systems in place that support that rather than try and teach people – to do things all in the same way. That's not going to help us right now. Einstein said that the systems that created the problems are not going to solve the problems we have. The systems cannot solve the problems they create. So it's going to come from more of a ground level, grassroots kind of group of people all over the world, all kinds of backgrounds with all sorts of ideas. Some aren't going to work, but, you know, what's wrong with throwing it out there and see what happens with it, you know? I do that all the time in coming up with roughs for logos. A lot of probably 80% of them get tossed in the trash can, except for those that I save to show my students to show process. But, you know, most designers don't keep that stuff because it's not workable stuff. But that doesn't mean that you don't go there, because you never know when you might unearth a gem that's really going to turn up a brilliant idea.
Speaking of Albert Einstein, I don't know if this is the one that's quoted in your book that you just said. And I wrote it down, and I can't find it right now. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
There was a quote from Einstein about make things simple but not too simple, which is also
right.
Simplicity does not mean stupidity. And a lot of people get those two terms confused. Simplicity means direct. It's a direct, usable, functional kind of a solution. But it's and then I love the idea of aesthetics, because aesthetics express the value of the function. So when you've got a beautiful design, which is kind of my area of work, you create it so it's beautiful and it leads the people in, and you might use a pattern from nature that appropriately fits with whatever the message is you're trying to convey, so that they intuitively get a sense of what it is, and if it interests them, they're naturally drawn to it. You know, it's not this bap, 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 run them up one side and down the other and just completely oversaturate so that anywhere they look, that's what they see. You know, this is the methods of a lot of huge corporate entities right now. Well, it's not a sustainable system for design or anything else. That it does not work to do massive amounts of anything. You have to have periods of latency for things to renew themselves. Just like in design, the analogy to that is you have to have white space. You've got to have empty space so the viewer can take a breath and is not completely overwhelmed at every moment with all this information. It's just not productive. It's not smart.
Mm-hmm. You know, I did find the quote. Actually, the quote I'm talking about comes under the section Intuition and Creativity. And Albert Einstein has said, the intuitive mind is a sacred gift, and the rational mind is a faithful servant. We have created a society that honors the servant and has forgotten the gift.
Yes, he said so many really great quotes. And, you know, this is the thing I find so fascinating about theoretical physics and the scientists, the theoretical people that are way out there on the edge. They're seeing the same things that people have seen eternally. Einstein recognized it. Feynman from Santa Fe Institute, he was one of the developers in Los Alamos. But these guys were working with the edges of reality, which is fascinating. That's, you know, to me, that's just a totally fascinating thing, because that's the act of being creative. You don't know where you're going to go with this stuff, and you have to pick up cues from the world around you, from the stuff you find, even if it's an intuitive cue. These are, you know, we tend to think everything has to be literal and we have to see it. It has to be quantified. But that's not necessarily true. The intuitive nature is very, very important to helping source something that's true. And so many physicists and brilliant thinkers have had the experience of just thinking and thinking and thinking an idea through or a problem through, and they just keep hitting a brick wall. And then something happens. Some little obscure connection happens, or they're in the shower, or they have a dream, and something comes to them, and then it pulls the whole story together. Mm-hmm. So this disregarding our intuitive natures is just a huge mistake, I think, in modern culture. It's not that one is better than the other or has better information. It's these two things should be used in partnership with each other. The two hemispheres of the brain, you know, same thing. The two hemispheres of the world. You can just take the analogy all the way out. It's about balance. That's all it's about.
Mm-hmm. This is Women's Focus that you're in tune to. My name is Carol Boss, and in the studio with me this afternoon is Maggie McNabb. She's the author of the new book, Designed by Nature. I'll tell you a couple of things I really love about this book. First of all, intellectually and philosophically, it's very exciting to me. And I want you to talk in a moment about how you have, how this book is designed. And I should say it's designed beautifully. It should be, because you are a designer writing about design, but it really, really is. But you have wonderful graphics. You have wonderful photographs. You have wonderful examples of what you're talking about. You have quotes that incredibly inspire me from all kinds of people, including scientists like Albert Einstein. And also included are, I don't know what to call them, but they're almost like essays. like the
from
short
other designers around the world.
It's really, really.
This book, I won't say it wrote itself because that wouldn't be accurate, but I do have to say that I wrote this book in an incredibly short period of time. I wrote it in 9 months, and on top of in 9 months,
that's amazing.
We had had a fire in our house February 1st, and that's just right after my contract with the publisher began, and I wrote the book in 7 different vacation rentals over the period of 9 months while we waited for our house to be repaired, and so, you know, it was just this whole experience of that intuitive thread that I was talking about earlier, finding things that fit appropriately to express certain concepts or ideas or principles that I was trying to get across in the book. And I drew from around the world. I've got famous designers in here that people in the design profession would recognize immediately, like Milton Glaser, who in the 70s came up with the I Heart New York logo. That's a sort of claim to fame. But he also did that very famous poster of Bob Dylan in that pop art style from 1967 that was included in Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits. I got that a few years later when I was 14 at the Candyman in Santa Fe and immediately fell in love with Bob Dylan. But that poster was on my wall. So to be able to communicate with Milton Glaser 40-odd years later and ask him for permission to use that in the book was amazing. But it's design is such an eclectic process, and there are architects in here like Buckminster Fuller. He's very important with his discoveries with the geodesic dome. And, you know, just a little side story about Buckminster Fuller that is so fascinating is he was unable to see in focus until he was about 4.5 years old. So he was not fitted for glasses. They didn't know that there was an issue really for a long time. And he saw in the broadest, fuzziest terms. He saw all of the relationships at once. And then when he was about 4.5, he began to see the details of how, you know, going from pattern to detail, which is one of the processes of a great designers use. You see the overall picture, and then you glean the most essential information out of it. Especially I do this as a logo designer. You pull out the most important information so you can express a symbol in a way that's meaningful and relevant and tells a little bit of a story about the client. So it works on a lot of different levels.
Can you give an example now? You just talked about going from pattern to design, whether it's in the pattern to details. Mm-hmm. Give an example of how that works, and it doesn't have to be someone like yourself, a designer, doing something, but how it, an illustration of
permaculture. Design, for example. Permaculture, I use the 3 maxims of permaculture, which are first to take care of the earth, because you've got to take care of what takes care of you. Second, you take care of people in your community, your relationships, your family, your friends, you know, the broader community. And then thirdly, you take care to not abuse things. You put controls on population, you put controls on use. That's the 3 maxims of permaculture. And then under that are a set of 12 principles, of which one is pattern to detail designing, meaning for a permaculturist, they need to really look at the contours of the earth. Where is the shade? Where are the slopes? What is the rainfall? What plant can shade this plant in the afternoon that would be too tender to be in direct sunlight? So that's kind of a broad example, but there are designers use the same principles. You understand how things work, and then you figure out the best ways to create the relationships between them so that, you know, it's not a constant monitoring process, whether it's a logo or a garden, so that it can be sort of self-sustaining and continue on in its life. And for logos, you know, logos are not typically, hopefully, something that's on just having a shelf life of like a year or two. Some of my logos have been out there for 25 years because they capture the essence of someone, and there's nothing to do with it. It's not based on trends. So trends can come and go, styles can come and go, but the substance of it is true and remains solid regardless of what's going on in the swirl around it of cultural changes.
I was taking a good look yesterday, and I don't know where it is in the book right now. As I'm just,
tell me what you're looking for. Maybe I can.
The Japanese company that had
Muji in Muji. Chapter 1. Yeah, and I talk about the distinction between, that's page 26. I talk about this distinction between emptiness and simplicity in the book, which is a distinction that Eastern culture has had really well for a long time, but a distinction that most Western people in Western culture don't seem to get. And the difference is a simplicity, which Muji is just, if you look at, you can just Google them if you want to online and look at some of their stores and look at their advertising. Muji has got this approach to advertising that lets you infer your own what you think is a fit for you. Like, there's not this hard bottom line kind of advertising. Like, it's not Walmart, you know, there's not sale signs all over the place. The store is designed in with wood, and there's not signs all over the place. You naturally gravitate to whatever is appealing to you, and it doesn't tell you to buy. It doesn't tell you there's a sale going on. It doesn't tell you this item is going to be gone. It's up to the customer to make those calls. And so it has this very broad appeal to all kinds of people, from a housewife to a student to an older retired gentleman. I mean, all of these people are encouraged by this. And so this is the idea of emptiness. This is where you go in and you figure out what appeals to you. It's basically asking you a question and to elicit your response to it. It's not telling you what to do, which is the method that most advertisers...
Right, very different from what the advertising
right,
in our culture...
which is simplicity, mm-hmm. which is distilling it down to one ultimate goal. Buy it. That's the ultimate goal. And I just think it's a good idea to have this alternative approach. Now, it may not be for every situation, but it's nice to feel like you have a choice when you go into a place and that you're not being bombarded and hawked at by every aisle you go down, you know. And in fact, I just don't go into those stores because, you know, life is already too fast and too filled with stuff that is not always very mm-hmm. useful. So why intentionally put yourself in that position to have to be subjugated to it?
Yeah, you include this photograph, which is a poster from Muji, which
the double spread.
Yeah, it's an unobstructed view of the Mongolian horizon, split perfectly between heaven and earth. And you say this poster from Muji communicates everywhere and all, or the receptivity of emptiness and equanimity or evenness of mind. Mm-hmm. Whereas I guess the ads here are just...
They fill you up.
They fill you up and distract you. Overload and...
Yeah. The idea is distraction.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Exactly.
So, and that model, well, you know, I think it's pretty clear to most people that model does not work and it's going to have to be changed. Or suffer the consequences, which we're already suffering a lot of the consequences. I mean, you know, what species fouls their own nest? It's just not, it makes no sense. So I'm talking about the true conservatives, the people who are really interested in conserving and being attentive and having awareness about what works and why does it work and how can I model that in whatever this particular problem is that has to be solved and use some of these principles and see if they might apply here too, because everything scales in the universe, you know, from the circular shape of an egg to the sphere of the sun, all the principle of this wholeness of being self-contained, just as the egg is once it gets fertilized, it's got everything it needs in it. You know, all of us were these little flat dots at one point. And look at what we've turned into. We've turned into these complex human beings with ideas and appendages and all this sort of stuff. It's really pretty amazing, but we never think about that stuff. You know, the stuff that's right in front of our face,
right.
We keep missing it, which I try to teach my students to really pay attention to, you know, what you have in here first, and then, you know, what's right outside of your periphery. And just pay attention to that. There's a couple. Well, the book is full of exercises. You probably noticed that,
yes,
too.
Yes, yes.
And this is hands-on. It's so you actually get an experience of it. And it's not just for designers. It's for anybody who's interested in doing creative work.
Just thumbing through it right now as I'm listening to you, I come across in section two, which is called Matter, Understand, and Create. There's an exercise on creating a personal mandala.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. And I haven't gotten to that with my students. This is the first time I've taught the book. I'm teaching at Santa Fe University Art and Design, and I've got most of my students are internationals. It's from, you know, they're part of the Laureate universities, and they're all over the world. And I've got I've got, I think, 8 Mexicans and 2 Brazilians and a couple of Americans. And so it's this great experience of coming from different cultures, but coming together with the common idea of solving a problem. And they'll be working on that in about 2 or 3 weeks.
So they're basically art and design students?
Yes.
You know what would be a really great idea?
What's that?
This is selfish motivation on my part. That you teach a class like for the rest of us who are not art and design students.
Oh, that's coming. Workshops.
Workshops.
Yeah. I'm actually negotiating a training video and a companion workbook to go along with Design by Nature right now. And that should be out towards the end of this year.
So the Muji poster that we were talking about and their philosophy is under the first section. And that's where you talk about
aesthetics,
simplicity, and emptiness and
right.
intuition and creativity. And this section is called, because this got me hooked, just the name. So that's what words do to me. Let's not even talk about the visuals, but just the words. Memory, remembering what we know. And where did that title come from for that section?
Well, that title came from the idea that human beings inherently come into the world with everything they need. Now, obviously, we have to be nourished and we have experiences that we can't determine ahead of time. But these things unfold us. It's the emergent property that every animal, human, living thing has got. And so the memory aspect is that we come in with everything we need, and then we get cues, we get stimulations from experiences, from relationships, from all of the stuff that we have in three-dimensional space. And it asks for our response to it. What is your personal response to this situation? So in my mind, anything that circumvents the personal response, because what else is there? If you have an individual capacity, then it's to contribute that in some way that is hopefully for the betterment of everyone else and for them to learn from and for you to learn from. So it's just the idea that we come complete and we unfold when we're given the opportunities to do that. And we usually unfold in very creative and pretty wonderful ways when we're allowed.
You know, I just had a thought. Repeat again what, not the last thing you just said, but before the unfolding, because I wanted to make a comment about it, but I wanted to remember how you phrased it.
The emergent piece?
No, after that.
Yeah. Having experiences and relationships that help us unfold?
You know what? I lost it. I'm going to have to think about this again.
We'll revisit
no,
that.
I thought it was actually kind of very sharp on my part to jump onto something, but now I sort of jumped
the
off of it.
The book is kind of dense. You know, my feedback I've gotten is that it's not a hard read, but like you say, it does get into philosophy. It is for everyone. It's got sections on, there's a section in the ethics part about street artists, and I illustrate a couple of things by Banksy. He was wonderful enough to let me use a few of his pieces in the book, as well as another street artist, another anonymous street artist who's French. Named Ludo, and he does this hybrid acid green gray palette combination of luxury brands with or nature with corporations. It's our mechanical looking things. It's just really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it's even if you're just thumbing through it, it's really in a lot
yeah,
of ways it's a lot of fun.
It's architects, street artists, designers,
mm-hmm.
and I also want to mention too that in the book I mentioned that there's a lot of famous designers in the book. Obviously, these guys and women have got tons of experience. They've got beautiful work. That's why I've included them. But I've also got student work on the same tier because I've had some student work that is just really incredible, and it's on a par with any of the most experienced designers I've ever seen.
This is Women's Focus. I'm Carol Boss, and here with me is Maggie McNabb, who is the author of Design by Nature. You talk about nature is always truthful. We're not always truthful with nature. I don't know if that's accurate, but talk about what you mean when you say nature is always truthful.
Well, nature, now I know that you can look at it in the with the idea that nature can give you a rough deal or a bad shake, you know, when you've got like awful weather or an earthquake or something like that. But nature is not personal with anything it does. Nature just does what's needed to be done in the moment. If you happen to get caught in the fray, I mean, that's unfortunate, but that's life. You know, that's the way life goes. It's not an intentional situation. So nature is just very direct with, like I was talking about, what needs to happen when it happens. Mm, yeah. Human beings, on the other hand, because we've got this ability of being so damn clever, is that we can actually be quite deceptive. And there's a lot of animals that have this ability, too, of being able to deceive, camouflage and whatnot. And these are developed, were developed as self-preservative sorts of things, self-preserving things. But human beings kind of take it to a rare art form sometimes and can be deceptive to the detriment of all. And I think that's why education really needs to come up to people to really understand how they're intuitively receiving things and not be sucked in by, you know, not be seduced by getting a quick fix on something, you know, food or goods or, you know, whatever it is. It's really, really important to take a larger, bigger view of things and understand what the cost is, not just to the rest of the world, but to you personally, because we all pay a price for immediate gratification.
Well, this may not be directly related, but what it reminds me of and that I want to ask you about now, because you do talk in your book about BP, British Petroleum, mm-hmm. and that sort of fits in with a topic of ethics of design.
Right. Yeah, that is in the ethics chapter.
And it fascinated me. And you want to talk about what, after the BP oil spill in the Gulf, what other designers around the world did with the BP logo.
Right, yeah. Unfortunately, it's a radio show, so I can't show it. But,
no, you can't.
But the basic message of that, and my first book, Decoding Design, really looked at breaking down the symbols of logos, including a lot of corporate logos. Well, the British Petroleum logo, everyone I'm sure is just very familiar with it now after the disaster that happened in 2010. But if you look on their website, it specifically says that that logo was redesigned when they had it redone, which I think they were rebranded maybe 8 or so years ago. And it was specifically done that way to show their focus on alternative energy and to look like both a sunflower and the sun and have this very green appearance. In fact, the primary colors are green and yellow. Well, this is a company that's out of integrity. So its identity is not appropriately and not correctly representing where their real focus is. And what happens when there is a lack of integrity is at some point, this is a lack of balance. Essentially, it's the same thing. At some point, there's a breakdown. And the breakdown occurred because the bottom line is the most important. And there's nothing wrong with making money. So I don't want to get that misconstrued. But the ways in which you make money can be quite distinct and can be very detrimental if they're not done correctly. And so the oil spill disaster that happened in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010 illustrated the fact that they were not primarily interested in alternative forms of energy. They were primarily interested in pumping out as much gas and oil as they could from the ocean floor at any cost. And people around the world, after that happened, everyone felt helpless. We saw that belching thing on the ocean floor. Who knows if it was looping or how accurate it was. But everybody felt put into this very helpless situation, knowing that the wildlife was being killed. And the way designers responded around the world was to redesign the BP logo. And you can just Google BP logo and you can see some of these amazing designs. I've got, I think, 5 or 6 examples. There's a couple of American designers. There's one from Israel. There's another from Australia. And designers around the world, they had, I don't know, something like 3,000 or 4,000 logos that were circulating around the web after that happened. And it was done quite spontaneously. People saying, okay, well, let's rectify this incorrect brand. This brand is not correctly representing the client.
What section is that in?
That is in Chapter 3, and it's on page, I can tell you right now, just a moment. It's on page 86.
86.
Right.
Yes.
And then across from that page is a poster done by Joel Nakamura, who is an international class illustrator who happens to live in Santa Fe, Japanese-American from California originally, who had two artist parents who teach at Whittier College. And Joel just does this amazing artwork, and I designed a poster for the students because he was coming in to speak to my students, so we put these up in the halls and whatnot. And with tools that we have these days like Google Translate, you can translate anything. So I got the Japanese version of "Take that, you British petroleum bastards," and had that done in Japanese characters on the popped out, you know, three-dimensional lettering like a Godzilla movie. So it was just, I could see that's a way to diffuse your anxiety, to diffuse your anger about things like that happening. It's a creative way to express the problem and bring up the awareness of other people.
Well, I'm curious now if Joel Nakamura has done anything graphic-wise, art-wise, in regards to the disaster in Japan.
I don't know that he has. His focus lately, he's got two younger children, and he's really been focused on the Japanese toys from like the 50s and 60s. He's been doing a lot of those things lately.
Can you give us a couple of examples of aha moments?
Let's see. Right off the top, I guess the biggest aha for me was that I could get a book like this done in 9 months. And you know the way I did it? I looked to nature and I really felt through what was true. What was true and right, and I don't mean true as in a fact. There's a big distinction between a fact and a truth. A fact is what is currently known in the moment with the technology and the awareness we have just right then. But a truth is something that's eternal. It doesn't change. It's always the same. You know, we're always going to have a horizon line out there that breaks the sky from the earth. And everybody, you may have a bumpy horizon line with mountains, or you may have a flat horizon line, but everybody always has and always will have that, the world expressed to them in that way through our senses. And so I think for me, the biggest aha, I can't come up with one right off the bat. I'm sorry, I'm just not prepared to answer that right off the bat. But for me, just the experience of writing this book and it feeling so right while I did it, you know, it was just, and the right illustration or the right designer's work just popping up in the moment that I needed it. And from all around the world, you know, the designer, Kenya Hara, who did the Muji stuff, is quite a famous guy in Japan. And he runs Muji. He's the creative director for Muji. And he's written a couple of really astounding books on design. One is called White, and the other is called Designing Design. And he's really the one that helped me capture that distinction between emptiness and simplicity. So simplicity, emptiness can be very simple because it's a very eloquent and simple expression with all the extraneous stuff stripped away. But simplicity is not necessarily empty. So these were just very subtle distinctions that are not typically in our culture. I have a lot of, I have a couple of Zen tenets in here and things like that because those practices slow. I'm not a Buddhist or anything like that, but I can certainly appreciate the practice of Buddhism and understand that it's a practice to help you slow down and not be in a continual distraction by the whirl around you. That's what the point of the mandala is to go to the center. That's why mandalas look the way they do. You focus on the center while all of the stuff is swirling around it. You hold your center.
We're running out of time, and I jotted down a question before I went on air this afternoon, and I wanted to ask you about this. So your book is for all those, you say, who are on the creative path, and that's certainly true for visual communication. So as someone who's a radio person, I'm wondering about verbal communication and how, if you can translate your theories of design, as you say, to create beautiful and functional visual communication, that can be translated to verbal communication as well.
Sure. I think people, I happen to be a real visual person, but I know that not all people are. Some are more verbally oriented. And it really comes down to connecting with what's in your heart and putting it out into the world courageously. You know, just being able to make your statement. And I believe that everyone as a human being has the right to do that. And in fact, it's a huge loss to the world if they don't do that.
Mm-hmm. So, Maggie, where can people find your book?
Well, in Albuquerque, I really like supporting the small bookstores. So I would recommend Bookworks on Rio Grande for purchasing the book locally here. Up in Santa Fe, Collected Works has got copies. you know, and that aside, there's always Amazon.
Are there any upcoming book readings? I know you've just done a couple.
I've just done a couple, and I'm getting ready now to jump into the next parts of the book. I am doing a webinar for Laureate Universities for the entire Western Hemisphere on Tuesday, but you need to be part of the Laureate system to participate in that. And I am doing a conference in Chicago. I'm a keynote in Chicago at the Fuse Culture and Identity Branding Conference. Locally, I don't have any other plans right now because I'm in the middle of teaching, but I know that things will be coming up. And I do have a website on the book, designbynaturebook.com. And I do, on the top page, put a news feed that lets everybody know what's coming up. And I am planning to teach workshops probably in 2013 or towards the end of this year.
All right, excellent. We ran out of time very quickly. This has been great. Thank you very much for driving down from Santa Fe.
Oh, thank you, Carol.
It's,
my pleasure.
It's a marvelous book.
Thank you so
really,
much.
Really wonderful. And you got a great foreword in there from someone named Debbie Millman, who I don't know who she is, but she said some great things about it.
The past president of the National AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Artists. It's about a 90-year-old organization. And to have the past president of that do the foreword to the book was just a real honor.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. And maybe we can end by me reading one thing that she wrote, that she said, she said that your hope for the book, it would inspire people to remember that while we are here on this planet, we can participate in the process of living by creating meaning with beauty. So that kind of
thank you
says a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol.